Well, I'm going to give you a little sketch of Christian attitudes toward sex, love, and marriage throughout the whole course of 2,000 years of history. It seems to me that there have been three major attitudes. One might be described as sacramental. It regards marriage as a lifelong association. The stress has been placed upon marriage for the purpose of having children. Fidelity is required, but not any romantic attachment. The second attitude is that of romantic love, which actually began in history, as I shall indicate, outside of marriage, and then was associated with marriage. And the third might be called the concept of marriage as a partnership in the having of children, in the rearing of children, in the fear of God, and in many joint enterprises, at first primarily the work of the church, in modern secularized form, a partnership due to community of taste in art, music, or professions, or something else. So the sacramental is lifelong. It may be very matter of fact and unromantic. The romantic is tender, chivalrous, but it may be brief. And if romance wanes, then marriage may be terminated, so that the romantic attitude by itself makes for instability in marriage. The partnership also may make for instability if the community of interest should cease later in life. So the one makes for stability, but it lacks the tenderness, the chivalry, and the excitement of a common enterprise. The others tend to be rather unsettling with regard to stability. Now I'll give a brief account of how these views have arisen in history and how they have interwoven with each other. One must bear in mind, of course, that at the outset, Christianity had behind it the Old Testament. And that was in some respects unfortunate. There are some practices in the Old Testament which the early Christians did not consider consonant with their attitudes, but which nevertheless have cropped up again in subsequent Christian history. The Jews, by the time of Christ, were monogamous, but Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob weren't. There was the polygamy of the patriarchs. Some explain it on the ground that the world was badly populated in those days, so God allowed an exception. We don't really need it now. But others have argued that the world wasn't too well populated in their day, and so they could start it again. There were some other regulations in the Old Testament. One, of course, was that the penalty for adultery was stoning. Jesus, in that passage which is not a genuine part of John's Gospel, but a comparatively early, the story of the woman taken in adultery, rejects this severity. In the 16th century, Erasmus said that if the penalty of stoning were revived for adultery, they'd have to use up a whole mountain for the stones. So sexual accident did not begin with the 20th century. There was an inconsistency in the Old Testament between two regulations. One was that a man could not marry his deceased wife's sister, nor a woman her deceased husband's brother. And that went into the law of the Western world. It was the law in England in my own father's lifetime. It's been changed since. Now, the contrary regulation was that if a man died, his brother could take his widow and raise up seed to him. That is, they would count as his dead brother's children. And that's the very contrary. And why they fastened on the one and not on the other in Western law, I don't know. But at any rate, they did. So in the Old Testament, you have the severity for adultery, but you have the allowing of divorce. Moses would allow a bill of divorce, and no reasons asked and no reasons given. Free divorce, severity for adultery, and that prohibition to which I referred, and the fact that very godly men had wives, and some of them, Solomon, had concubines. Of course, some of the early church fathers said that this really didn't mean actual women, that they stood for virtues, and the more virtues Solomon had, of course, the better. But this allegorizing did not commend itself to all. And this then lay in the background of early Christianity. Now, in the New Testament, there's not too much said on the subject. In the case of the Gospels, we have the presence of Jesus at the marriage of Cana. We have his statement that marriage was instituted by God at the very beginning, and that on that account, one should leave father and mother and cleave to the wife or to the husband, and that what God had put together should not be put asunder. One has in Mark the absolute prohibition of divorce, but in Matthew the qualification that divorce is permissible for adultery. There are some who think that Mark, being the original gospel, in Matthew we have a modification introduced perhaps by the evangelist himself, who thought the absolute prohibition was too severe, and therefore allowed one exception. But some interpret the passage in Mark to mean this: Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, allowed divorce. Now, of course, you shouldn't have hard hearts. But if you do have hard hearts, then you may be allowed divorce. Of course, genuine Christians would not have hard hearts. In other words, in this case, that Jesus is not condemning Moses, he recognizes the necessity of this concession to hardness of heart. The inference would be then that divorce may be allowed for more reasons than adultery. Well, all of this depends upon the interpretation of particular texts. There is more on the subject when we come to Paul in the first letter to the Corinthians in the 7th chapter, where he discusses the whole relationship. He says that marriage is approved of God, that marriage is an honorable estate and the bed is undefiled. He will not permit separation because of diversity of belief. If, for example, a pagan couple are divided in that after their marriage, the wife, let us say, has become a Christian and the husband has not, the marriage is not to be dissolved. Of course, the early church tried to keep marriages within the fold, but Paul's point was that if a marriage was already there and then there came to be a division, the marriage should stand. He thought it preferable, however, that the unmarried should not get married, and he adds the reason: because of the shortness of the time. In other words, he expected a very speedy return of Christ. And for that reason, it was not important to change your status. If you were a slave, you needn't hurry to be free. If you were married, you needn't want to be unmarried, or if you were unmarried, to be married. He said it would be preferable not to be married because the married have so many cares with which they are preoccupied, and he thought it better that they should be spared this because of the shortness of the time. But that reason of Paul dropped out of the picture when the time turned out not to be short. And we have then his approval of marriage, but the fact that he would prefer that all should be as he led to the view which prevailed later in the church, that marriage should be regarded as a sacrament approved of God and yet inferior to virginity or celibacy. This came to be the prevailing view. Paul has said that although he would discourage the marriage of the unmarried, nevertheless, if they were not able to control themselves, it would be better that they should be married rather than that they should be tormented by passion. This view of marriage was called in the Middle Ages the view which looked upon it as the remedium peccati, the remedy for sin. A very low view of marriage, but one which was very prevalent and was derived from that particular verse. Now, when we come to the early church, we have these views very largely continued. The church holds strictly to monogamy, severely condemns all sexual irregularity. Paul does that too. Unnatural vice, incest, and so on. He speaks against in no measured terms, and so does the church throughout. In the early church, there were three unforgivable sins, namely bloodshed, apostasy, idolatry or apostasy, denial of the faith, and sexual irregularity. They call it fornication. That would include adultery. God might forgive, but not the church. If you were guilty of any of these three, you couldn't get back into the fellowship. Now, little by little, the bars went down. And first of all, for those who had denied the faith, many of them had been tortured before they gave in, and it was felt only right that if they were penitent, after a time they should be readmitted. And next, the bars went down with regard to those who had committed sexual offense, and with due evidence of penitence, they were allowed to return. That happened in the early 3rd century, and when the bars went down on bloodshed, we don't know. For a long time, even a soldier who killed in war had to do penance before he could be received to communion. So in the early church, at the outset, adultery was regarded as one of the unforgivable sins. As for marriage itself, this was a lifelong relationship. Its purpose was the having of children and the rearing of children. Not very much is said about partnership in marriage. There are some passages with regard to the holding of common religious exercises together. And Chrysostom gives a little advice to married couples, though he gives it mainly to the husband. He says a wife ought not to complain of her husband. She ought not to say to him, "Now, that man over there has 2 white mules for his wife, and you don't have any mule at all for me." He says, "Really," he said, "there's a lot of debate between the 2 mule family and the 1 mule family." He says, "If you've got 1 mule, they both want it. If you've got 2 mules, usually 1 mule has a sore foot and is out in the pasture, and you have a bigger dispute over the remaining mule than if you didn't have any mule. So really preferable not to have any mule at all." But if she complains that she doesn't have as many mules, you should say to her, "My dear, I could have married much wealthier women than you. But I chose you because I loved you." And then introduce a few circumlocutions about the vanity of riches. This is Chrysostom's advice on family matters. In the early church, the question of contraception came up. This was in the early 3rd century. And the question arose because there were in the church more women of the nobility than men. The men had a larger number in the slave category and the women in the nobility. Now, the church wanted to keep the marriages within the fold, but the women of the nobility wouldn't marry the slave men because they would take the status of the husband and become slaves. Therefore, the church agreed that they might have these slave men as concubines. The word concubine technically doesn't necessarily refer to a woman. It's a sexual partner without the benefit of the law of marriage. It's not legally recognizable as marriage, and it doesn't give any rights to the party who's a concubine if there's a divorce or inheritance or anything else. Now, the church said that although in the eyes of the Roman law, this relationship is concubinage, in the eyes of the church, it's marriage, because it is a lifelong relationship with fidelity of the one to the other. This is the first time that the church enacted laws that were different from the laws of the empire. And as you know, later there came to be church courts and church law, as well as civil courts and civil law. This is the first time where you have a law of the church that differs from the law of the empire. These noble women could have the slave men with the legal status of concubinage. Well, then, they didn't want to have any children, because the children would take the status of the man, even if he was only a concubine. Therefore, contraception. And the Bishop of Rome came down on that hard. They could have the men as concubines, but they must be willing to have children. Now, this is the first instance, and you will see that it was directed against those who did not want to have any children at all. There's a very fine book on this whole subject that's just come out by a Catholic scholar, Nonan, N-O-O-N-A-N, entitled Contraception. And he points out how, in one instance after another, and I'll tell you some more, the ethic of the Catholic Church on this subject was gradually built up, but with many exceptions along the way. His feeling is that there is not a tradition in Catholicism which would prevent them from recognizing contraception. And this is just a scholarly book by a Roman Catholic, come out quite recently, and he refers to this particular incident. In Constantine's time, after Christianity had come to be recognized by the empire, so many people came into the church with little preparation that the more ardent spirits withdrew not only from the church but from the world and went into the desert, first of all as hermits. And that meant, of course, as celibates. Then, having renounced the world and having left sex behind, sex became an obsession. And the stories of the early monks are just full of stories of how they would be tormented by their dreams and think that the devil appeared in the guise of a beautiful woman, and then with a leer would disappear, and so on. These stories are all full of this sexual material, and part of the reason for the extreme asceticism was to subdue the flesh so that there would be no sexual passion. Saint Jerome found a better device. He was a hermit out in the desert. He used to beat his breast with stones to try to subdue his passion, and it didn't work. So he took up the study of Hebrew, and that filled his mind, and that was more successful. So this study is to be heartily recommended. But then in the West, we come to St. Augustine, and he more than any other formulated the subsequent Catholic ethic in this regard. St. Augustine, before his conversion, had lived with a concubine whom he could not marry because she was below him in a social status. In the course of 15 years, they had only one child. He said, uninvited, but loved for his own sake. After he became a Christian, he reproached himself, not that he'd had a concubine, but that they'd had only one child. And the reason was that he belonged to the sect of the Manichees in that period. Now, the Manichees held that the flesh is evil, that to imprison a new soul in the flesh is a great offense against that soul, and that it's not so bad, though it is bad, to have sexual relations as it is to imprison souls by births. Consequently, you see, they practiced a contraception, and Augustine obviously had done that during that period. Now he comes out with a very strong condemnation of the refusal to have children. He completely repudiates the whole Manichaean position. In his reaction, he declares that the almost sole object of marriage is progeny, that there should be sexual relations only for the sake of progeny. He does not know a single married couple who has ever held itself to this rule. He thinks, however, that if they do have relations for any other purpose in marriage, that will be a venial sin, a minor sin. Though if it's outside of marriage, it'll be a major sin, a mortal sin. So he takes really the view that you can't, well, it's pretty hard to be married without committing at least some venial sins. And for that matter, he takes the view that even in the sexual relationship, although it is God's way of propagating the human race, he seems to wish God had thought of another way, but God did. But even so, there will be sin, and the sin here consists in the lack of rationality, of being carried away by a passion and losing rational control over one's behavior. So he feels that in birth and through the sexual act, there is a certain taint. It is this view which Augustine formulated mainly in opposition to the Manichaean view, which prevailed throughout the West in Europe and conditioned the attitudes of the Catholic Church down to our own time. His view I would classify under the sacramental view. It is lifelong and it is for progeny. By the way, the favorite text for this position was that from Genesis, be fruitful and multiply. But Father Nonon points out in his book that in the New Testament, there is nowhere a statement that the only purpose of marriage is the having of children, and that the only purpose of sexual relations is the having of children. Now, in the Middle Ages in the West, we have a new social situation. City life broke down. The whole culture became agrarian. People lived on their farms. Wealth consisted in land. And marriage came to be a device, in part, for the uniting of farms, the uniting of noble families, making alliances with princely houses. So that marriage became a part of the entire social structure and a device for maintaining its stability. Marriages were made by the family and with regard to the personal desires of those involved, and especially in noble houses, there might be engagements when the child was 1 year old, 2 year old, 3 year old, and sometimes kings would affiance their children before they were born, provided the sexes turned out to be correct for the purpose. If not, they had to make a little shift. But the point is that this is totally unromantic. It is a family arranged union. One is not to suppose that people under such arrangements hate each other. They do not get married because they're in love. They come to love each other because they've gotten married. And often there may develop a very genuine affection and a tender regard. Marriage of this kind has prevailed in the Oriental countries right down to our own generation. It's only just passing in India, in China, and in Japan. We have an interesting illustration in the West of John Marshall, who was the regent of England after King John. And he was made the Earl of Pembroke. And along with all of the possessions of the Duchy of Pembroke went the Duchess. So he married the lady. They became very devoted to each other. And when he was dying, she was brought into his bedchamber. He spoke to her in French. This is the period of Norman England. Ma chérie, tu es venue pour me baiser pour la dernière fois. My sweetheart, you have come to kiss me for the last time. And she kissed him and went out of the room in unconsolable sorrow. Now that was almost a business marriage, you might call it, a matter of the uniting of lands, but it did result in a tender affection. Yet, as I say, there was no thought that there needed to be romance in this situation. This view of marriage did make for stability. Marriages were not to be broken up, except for very, very extreme reasons. But it also tended toward leniency with regard to extramatrimonial relations, particularly with regard to the man. And in noble houses and with kings, it was practically taken for granted, and the wife assumed it, that he might have relations according to his fancy. The king's mistress became almost an institution. Perhaps you read a novel by Steinbeck called Pippin the Third. It's a good deal of a satire. He says they restored the monarchy in France and they had to get a man of the royal house, and they had to go clear back to Pippin to find a line of succession. And the man who was in the succession was actually very happily married and very much of an erudite, an unworldly professor whose chief interest was in astronomy. He didn't want to be the king of France. But it landed on him, so they made him the king, and then they brought him his mistress. What am I going to do with a mistress? I don't want a mistress. Yeah, well, it goes with the job. So this relationship does make, well, both for stability is marriage as a formal union, and the home, the man who has these relations doesn't abandon his wife and his children and his home, but it does lead toward a lenient attitude with regard to irregularities. Then in the 12th century arose the cult of romantic love, and it arose outside of marriage, and partly as a protest against the emphasis which the church was placing upon the superiority of virginity, because this is the period in which clerical celibacy was imposed upon the clergy. A very large propaganda campaign was used in order to persuade the clergy to become a celibate, and these tracts simply vilified marriage. Well, said these people in the courts of love, if marriage is that bad, why bother? But they had no intention of becoming celibate. It was in the courts of love in southern France, in Provence and Angoulême, that this cult arose. It is somewhat of an enigma to historians who feel there's nothing quite like it in previous history, because this cult of romantic love had a religious quality. The beloved was exalted almost to the eminence of a goddess. To be sure, people had fallen in love before. We have the Songs of Solomon in the Old Testament. We have the story of Isaac and Rebekah, of Jacob working the 7 extra years for Rachel, and so on. But we don't have any lyrical rhapsodies with an almost religious tinge with regard to the glories of the beloved. Moreover, her qualities were supposed to be transmitted to her lover. He must be absolutely faithful to her. This romantic love called for fidelity, but not for marriage. And the woman might already be married. Eleanor of Aquitaine presided over these courts of love, and she said that love and marriage are absolutely incompatible. She had some reason to think so. She had been married to the King of France, and then that marriage had been dissolved, and she was married to Henry II of England. She was the mother of Richard de Coeur de Lion and King John and several others. But toward the end of her life, her husband kept her in practical captivity and amused himself with Fair Rosalind. She said that marriage and love are just simply not to be combined. The poetry of the troubadours centers upon this romanticized passion. Some have said that its object was not the gratification of the flesh, because there is so much moaning over ungratified passion. And the suggestion has been made that the object of the cult of love was not to find satisfaction, but to enjoy the inability to achieve satisfaction. That it is the cult of unfulfillment. But that was an entirely appropriate comment. The poetry of the troubadours does not sound as if what they were after was simply perpetually to be unfulfilled. The real basis for this interpretation is the story of Tristram and Isolde, where they could come together, puts the sword between them, and the only resolution is death. But it has been pointed out that this poem does not originate in the courts of love, but has been taken over and recast. Here, then, is a glorification of romance, and it is dissociated from marriage. Later on, marriage and romance come to be conjoined. The first instance in real life where we have a conflict and an unresolved conflict between the concept of marriage as a lifelong relationship for the sake of children, as a romantic attachment, and finally, the third ingredient, a partnership in a common endeavor, is in the love affair of Abelard and Eloise, and I'll give you a very brief account. Abelard was the most distinguished teacher of his day, a great philosopher. In many respects, he founded the whole scholastic method. I can't go into detail about that, but one must bear in mind that Abelard was a man of distinction, for otherwise the story makes very little sense. When he was about 40, and at the pinnacle of his fame as a teacher, for students flocked to him in Paris from all over Europe, his attention was called to Eloise, who was about 18, and already precocious in her intellectual development. He sought to become her tutor, and her uncle gave him permission to come and lodge in his home and to give her a thrashing if she were not dutiful in her studies. Abelard instructed her in theology, dialectic, logic, Greek, and a smattering of Hebrew, but there were soon more kisses than theses. His classes began to be neglected, and songs of the troubadours were heard coming from the windows of Canon Fulbert's house. What began as an intellectual partnership was moving into a romantic attachment. Canon Fulbert was entirely oblivious to what was going on and couldn't believe that the great Abelard would misbehave. But by and by, Eloise, not with sorrow but with joy, informed Abelard that she was to become a mother. He stole her away and took her to his family home in Brittany, where they remained until the birth of their son, whom they named after a newly discovered astronomical instrument and called him Astrolabe. This is indicative of their intellectual partnership. Abelard then insisted that they should marry. Some suggest that he did so because he felt that was the only way in which he could pay his debt to Canon Fulbert, whose hospitality he had violated. But Eloise strenuously objected. She said, you don't seem to realize what's involved. You must remember that you are a teacher. Now, teachers were expected to be celibate, for the new reform had gone through to that extent. They received fees from their students, but not enough to support a family. She said, how are you going to carry on? She said, if we have a little house and a family, do you think you'll be able to continue as a philosopher amid all of the clamor of the household? What has the distaff to do with the pen of the philosopher? If we were wealthy and had a big house and you could have a room off by yourself, that might be another matter. But we're not going to be wealthy. And if we're going to be able to carry on at all, you will have to take on some other form of employ. But if you do, then your preeminence in the university world will be at an end, because to intermit is to omit. If you give up for a while, you'll lose your grasp on all this material which you handle so magnificently. I'm not going to be the one to take you away from the universities and the church. Well, then what? Well, she said, ideally, we ought to part, and you should continue on the road which looks toward the priesthood and celibacy. He was in minor orders. That would be better. She seems to think that virginity is superior to any other solution. But she said, if we continue, I would rather be your mistress than an empress. I do not wish to be your wife, because marriage is a yoke of bondage. The wife is the property of her husband. I do not want yours, but you. It's a passionate protest of personal romantic love and devotion against a view of marriage which made it a property affair, even in the literal sense, where the wife was the property of her husband. But to please Abelard, she agreed to the marriage, and they were married. Canon Fulbert, then Abelard asked to have it kept secret. And Canon Fulbert thought that he was getting ready to get a dispensation from the Pope which would relieve him of the marriage. And Canon Fulbert took a foul revenge and sent some of his men who overpowered Abelard and deprived him of his manhood. Feeling that this was a judgment of God upon him, he plunged into a monastery, but a married man couldn't take the vows unless his wife did too. So he persuaded Eloise to become a nun. Then he had a long series of troubles over theological matters, for he brought out various works which were held to be heretical in the eyes of the church. He was finally banished, but he was given permission to be a hermit, and he went out into the forest of Compiègne, and there he began living in a little hut. But how was he going to live? The nuts weren't enough to carry him all through the winter. There was only one thing he knew how to do, and that was to teach. So he took in a few boys tutoring, and the word went out that Abelard was teaching, and the students flocked out to the forest of Compiègne and threw up little huts just here, like a new home springing up in the wilderness. And he built there a little chapel which he dedicated to the Holy Spirit, the Comforter. But then he was accused of heresy because he dedicated it to the Holy Spirit and not to all the Trinity. And it was claimed that the other two would be offended. Oh, my Lord, said I. The Son has his feast at Easter, and the Father is worshipped all the year, and why should they be offended? He said, maybe I better go to Spain and take refuge with the Moors. But he did escape from that situation and was made an abbot in Brittany. But there he found that the new reforms about clerical and even monastic celibacy had not penetrated, and there the monks had concubines and the whole place was full of little monklings. Then he tried to reform them and they tried to assassinate him. And finally he came out with a book which he hoped would enable him to return to teaching, entitled The Story of My Calamities. It gives his autobiography. It fell into the hands of Eloise. This was 20 years after the catastrophe. And he received a letter. To her lord, her husband, from his servant, his wife, to her brother, from his sister, to her master, from his servant, from Eloise to Abelard. Why did you not write all this to me? And why did you not give me comfort? He wrote that he didn't think that she needed it and asked her for her prayers. She wrote back, I cannot pray for you. My intercession will do no good, for I am not penitent. And even in the most solemn moments of the Mass, my body is a quiver with remembrance. I hope only I may find a little corner in heaven to save me from the abyss. Abelard wrote back, turning her attention from himself to the heavenly bridegroom, what did he who endured the crown of thorns, the scourging, and the cross? Why did he undertake all this for you? It is because he is the perfect lover. He wants not yours, but you. Somewhat chastened, Eloise wrote back and said, you used to write such beautiful love poems. Won't you write some hymns for the sisters? Because, in the meantime, she herself had become an abbess. He did write some hymns, and one of them is in most of our hymn books. And the tune is still being used, O quanta qualia. Oh, how many and how great are all the joys of the eternal Sabbath, when all the torments of this life are gone, and we enter into the heavenly Jerusalem. I can't quote it to you exactly. It's in Latin, of course. It is an exquisite poem, and as I say, you'll find it still in many of our hymn books. So for the moment terminates this correspondence. Now, modern scholars suggest that it was an edited correspondence. that, as a matter of fact, they've been corresponding for 20 years because some of the letters don't seem to fit the situation. And they wonder whether 20 years afterward she would have spoken with such passionate resentment when she was now an abbess and a mother superior to her own nuns. They suggest that Abelard did neglect her for a month or two after the catastrophe, and that then when the first letter came, she was full of passionate recrimination against the whole situation. She also refers to a previous letter, which isn't in the collection. It looks, therefore, as if Abelard took a long correspondence, edited it, put in quotations from the church fathers, almost submerging some of these passionate personal elements, and then put it out as an appendix to a new edition of the Historia Calamitatem. What it will mean in that case is, oh, and by the way, the nunnery where she was closed, and she had nowhere to go, so he came back from Brittany, found her, took her to the forest of Compiègne, where all those huts were now unused, set her up there with her sisters, and arranged for her to be made an abbess. All that he'd been doing in the meantime, he hadn't neglected her. And a very interesting thing is that in one of his works, he considers the possibility that a eunuch might be made a chaplain to nuns. Apparently he's wondering if that isn't the place for him, alongside of Eloise. But it wasn't to be. He was accused of heresy. There was a trial. The end of it all was he was finally allowed to take refuge in the monastery of Cluny with Peter the Venerable, who treated him kindly. And there he grew old and full of gentleness until the monks felt that he was truly a saint. When he died, they wanted to keep his body to work miracles with. But Eloise wrote to Peter, oh, they made a great deal of the bodies of saints, but they'd even take their fingernail pairings for miracles. They wanted his body, but Eloise wrote and said, send his remains to me. And Peter the Venerable stole them away and fulfilled her request. She laid them in the little chapel of the Holy Spirit, the Comforter. She followed him 20 years later and was laid beside him. And afterwards, their remains were removed to the cemetery of Père Lachaise in Paris, where still they sleep side by side. Well, now, this is the first example in history, I think, where you have the ideal of marriage and a family, because it's obvious, I think, from the correspondence that that's what she really wanted, but thought it wasn't economically practical. Next comes, if the circumstances were right, that would have been her preference. And it would have been a lifelong relationship. It was based upon an undying romantic attachment. And it was associated with a partnership in intellectual pursuits, where she studied with him all the church fathers. In that age, with the emphasis on clerical and monastic celibacy, with the inadequate salaries of teachers, the problem could not be resolved. Well, toward the Renaissance period, we begin to have the romanticizing of marriage. You'll find it in Wolfram von Eschenbach. You'll find it in Christine de Pisa, in Ermanno Barbaro in Italy. You find it in the 16th century in Edmund Spenser. Marriage becomes romanticized. In Shakespeare's Tempest, well, the first stage is that if you have a romantic attachment, there should not be sexual relations until after marriage. You have that in Shakespeare, in The Tempest, first we'll wed and then we'll bed. The next stage is to say that there shouldn't be a marriage unless there has been a romantic attachment. And that's the prevailing view in our society today. And of course, the third conclusion is that if the romantic attachment ceases, then the marriage ceases, and that's the Hollywood stage. So the romanticizing of marriage refines it, but it also may make for instability. Now the third, where there's a great emphasis on unity in a common task, receives its largest development through the Reformation, though not particularly through Luther. His own marriage, of course, was not premeditated. A group of nuns under his teaching left the nunnery and were smuggled into Wittenberg inside empty herring barrels. A contemporary said, "A whole wagon load of Vestal virgins has just come to town." God grant the marriage, lest worse befall. So Luther had them on his hands. He joked about it. Finally, he had arrangements made for all of them, except one. An arrangement had been made for her, but the young man's family objected to his marrying an escaped nun, and he called it off. And this was Catherine from Bora. So Luther picked out another man for her and said, "I won't take him." But she hinted that she would be willing to take Luther. Well, Luther hadn't considered it. Sometimes earlier, he said, "I approve of clerical and monastic marriage, but they're not going to give me a wife." But now, when the suggestion was given, he thought there was something to be said for it. It would please his father, and it would displease the Pope. And since Christ was coming soon, he might never have another chance. So he married Catherine and became very devoted to her, often teased her a bit, called her "my Lord Katie" and that sort of thing. She took him in hand. He needed to be taken in hand. Before he was married, he never made his bed for a year. And he'd give away every blessed thing he'd got. After they were married, he wrote to a friend and said, "I'm sending you a wedding present. P.S. Katie's hit it." They had six children, and he took in a lot of student boarders and relatives. They had a household of about 25. She supervised the whole thing. She did all the slaughtering herself. She brewed his beer. He thought no beer was as good as Katie's. Managed the entire household and then took on a little farm nearby and supervised that. She's worthy of 2-3 biographies. He spoke of marriage in eloquent terms, but as I said, it began because he had an obligation. And he carried through with fidelity and devotion. He has a number of sermons on marriage. He says, "You know, the devil is very busy. He spends all of his time breaking up marriages, and I have to spend so much time putting them together again, I've hardly got time to get my sermons." Some things didn't happen yesterday. But the idea of partnership in anything other than having a household is scarcely in Luther. You'll find that rather in Calvin. And one result of it is to admit of divorce. Luther wouldn't. He said he preferred bigamy to divorce. Of course, he didn't consider bigamy ideal, but there were some circumstances in which it would be better for a man to have two wives and be faithful to it, and be faithful than to be promiscuous. And he'd rather have bigamy than divorce. He said the Bible had forbidden it. But the Calvinists interpreted it otherwise. And now there was Caraccioli, the Marchese di Vico, an Italian nobleman in the court of Charles V, who, while he was in the north, was converted to Protestantism. And when he broke the news to his wife, she regarded him as a heretic, would have nothing to do with him. He pled with her to come with him into exile, and with the six children. But she was adamant. At the risk of his life, and it was at the risk of his life, because the Roman Inquisition had been introduced, he went back to Italy, back home again. His wife embraced him, the children threw their arms about him, they thought he'd come back to stay, but when he told them that he had come only to take them with him if they would, or to return alone, his wife and older relatives heaped curses upon him, and his 12-year-old girl threw her arms about his legs. Father was back. Why did he have to go? He went down to the ship and sailed into permanent exile. 2 years later, he married an Italian refugee woman. Having been granted a divorce by the divines of Geneva on the ground that if a woman would not follow her husband into exile for religion, the relationship was terminated. Now you see, this is beginning to make partnership in religion a condition for marriage. And if that isn't there, even to dissolve a marriage. This concept of the partnership is developed even more in Puritanism. And particularly among the Quakers, George Fox married a widow, Margaret Fell. They were both fairly well along in years. I think their marriage ran through about the last 10 years of their lives. And during that whole time, they were almost never together because they were in prison separately. Constantly being condemned to prison because of their belief, and to separate prisons. But they carried on a very affectionate correspondence. Quaker men and women went out on missions together. The Anabaptist couples had done it in the previous century. So that a joint enterprise in the work of the Lord was regarded as, well, the proper thing for those who were members of a religious group. So here, partnership is a very important concept with reference to marriage. New England Puritanism and English Puritanism had that note, and in all of their correspondence they stressed the point that God comes first. John Knox wrote to his fiancée, "After God, I love thee more than any other creature." And it was God first. And Oliver Cromwell writes to his wife in a very similar strain, "God first." It's somewhat like the poem, "I could not love thee, dear, so much loved I not honor more." And in this case, loved I not God more. The New England Puritans were rather matter-of-fact about marriage. They weren't romantic. They would pick out a suitable person and make a proposal, and if accepted, that was that. They got married first and they fell in love afterwards. They were not frigid with regard to sexual relations, but they were not romantic with regard to the way in which marriages were to be brought about. The Pietist sects often tended toward asceticism and toward reviving the old view of Augustine that the only legitimate function of sexual relations, the exclusive function, is the having of children. Well, now, of course, you know as well as I what has happened in recent periods. It's rather the disruptive aspects which have been stressed. The partnership idea has been secularized into community of tastes, similarity of vocation and so on, rather than a common religious devotion. And frequently married couples in after years will begin to shift in their tastes, and then they feel that their marriage is terminated. The sacramental lifelong view has tended to be very greatly weakened by the romantic on the one hand and the partnership idea on the other, because neither of those is of necessity permanent. My own feeling is that a satisfactory marriage has got to involve all three, and that the absence of any one means an impoverishment with regard to the others. How to hold them together is our question, and of course there is the further complication that the whole structure of our society is altered. The family-made marriage fit in with the agrarian economy, and now we have an urban. The diversity of occupations and pursuits in which women can engage offers a multiplicity of opportunities and of shifting interests. So the whole relationship in our day has become much more complex than it was in any of the previous centuries. But still the ideal, I think, is to try to hold the three in conjunction.